one of the biggest elements of my book is this concept of humility. When you go outside your home turf, whether it's a state or a country, humility becomes our biggest asset. We never pay, but what we do is we do a ton of corporate social responsibility. And so we build a clinic, or we donate an ambulance, or we build a library and we have a grand opening, or we're donating an ambulance, or whatever it is. These women who are, 18 to 44, call them 25 to 35, right? Most of them do not have the money to buy a property, but they are going to move. And many of them are already coming. The digital nomad wave is happening. I mean, many of these countries have actually created what they call digital nomad visas. You put one car dealership way out of town, maybe some people come to it. You stick 15 car dealerships along a mile, everyone goes there, right? And so this idea of cluster, there's empirical data that supports it. The cluster element works. And so I want to do everything I can to help as many people get overseas.
Let's get one thing straight before we roll into today's episode. Moving overseas might sound like sipping mojitos under a palm tree, but there's much less Instagrammable side to it too. And our guest today, he is not just living abroad, doing business abroad. He's been building communities in Latin America for over 25 years, Belize, Nicaragua, Panama. Mike Cobb, welcome to Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. Before we get started.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. And before we get started, what I really want to know is, how does a white guy not get his ass handed to him and stripped of everything he owns while building in foreign countries?
But you know what? That's a great question. Very carefully, and not always the case, actually. Before we went on, you said something about horror stories. I mean, we've been ripped off. We've had lots of horror stories over the years. I think that the key is every time that something doesn't go well or doesn't go as you planned, to look at look at what you did right. I think a lot of times people focus immediately on what you did wrong, right? But I like to focus on what did we do right and what did we do wrong, right? Because I think we want to double down on everything that was correct. And we then obviously want to look at what we did wrong. And when we do that, because typically it involves cost, monetary cost, I view that as tuition. And we talk about it in our organization as tuition. Like when we make mistakes, when we screw up, or when somebody, screws us, right? Because that does happen. It's tuition. So we want to learn as much as we possibly can from that experience, both good and bad, and then, move on, right? But when it's tuition, it changes the mindset, right? It says, okay, what do we learn? Like, how are we going to do it better next time?
Right. Well, and we've done plenty of projects in the States. Mostly my business, we've been working primarily in the Pacific Northwest for the last 20 plus years, but recently started going into other jurisdictions or other states, I should say, here even talking to different cities, city of Seattle, city of Kent, city of Bellevue, city of Tacoma, just around here. And you've got different cultures, different attitudes, different ways that they like doing things. When you're crossing not just municipal borders, but national borders, cultural borders, how do you navigate that? Like when you go into a new place, where do you start?
Yeah. Great question. First of all, it's in my book. I think one of the biggest elements of my book is this concept of humility, right? That I think humility is our strongest asset when we go anywhere outside our home turf, right? If you go to a new jurisdiction, new city, a new state, now you're talking about all kind of new regulations, right? So when you go outside your home turf, whether it's a state or a country, humility becomes our biggest asset. So any kind of assumption that we might have, we need to test it. Like, does it really hold true where we are now? Some do, some don't, right? I think there's certainly physical principles that hold true everywhere. There's probably generally development expertise, technical information that would hold true. But when you start to talk about customs, culture, law, regulation, implementation, right? Implementation of law, regulation, like those are the areas where there's just a ton of gray area. And so one of the things that we counsel people on, I do a lot of consulting for folks, a lot of due diligence research, for people going overseas, in addition to, you know, having our own business, is let's test. Let's test and validate every single thing, every single assumption that we're bringing that's beyond technical, right? I mean, technical stuff's technical, right? But at the end of the day, anywhere there's a gray area, we want to test, we want to validate, we want to approach with humility. And there are no dumb questions. Lots of little hacks. I mean, if it's okay, I'll throw a couple hacks out there. I'm a huge fan of multiple lawyers, right? You want to have a business lawyer, a corporate lawyer, right? Business corporate law, right? You want to have someone who's more of a development construction lawyer who understands that industry. And then you also want to have a third lawyer who's very, very, very local. Tip O'Neill, right? The Speaker of the House back when Reagan was president, right? He said, all politics is local, right? And here's Speaker of the House, right? At the National, Congress, right? But all politics is local. And so that third lawyer is just a small town lawyer in whatever town you're in your case, or county or whatever it is, or municipality where we are, who knows everybody, knows the history of the people, the relationships, the property, knows how to get things through a bureaucratic system. We're not talking about bribery. I've been working in the region 33 years and we've never paid a bribe. 33 years of working in Latin America. By the way, your first question was, how does a white guy avoid getting, skinned alive? I think one of the things a smart white guy does is never pays a bribe. Because truly, the first time you pay a bribe in Latin America as a foreigner, just go down to the tattoo parlor and get a big dollar sign put right here, green, bright green on your forehead.
There's going to be a line out the door.
I pay, right? And so we as an organization, and I counsel people to do the same, we never pay. But what we do is we do a ton of corporate social responsibility. And so we build a clinic, or we donate an ambulance, or we build a library, whatever. We do tons of stuff. We work with schools and moms and kids. Anyway, whenever we do something that's actual physical, right? And we have a grand opening, or we're donating an ambulance, or whatever it is, we invite the local officials. We bring coolers of sandwiches and sodas and a pinata for the kids, and maybe there's, 20 of us gringos hanging around, and, 100 or 200 of the local folks that are going to be there. The mayor gets to cut the ribbon. All of us hang out till the pinata's broken, 15 minutes, sandwiches distributed. All the gringos get on their cars or the bus and go away. And the mayor gets to hang out with his constituents for the next 3, 4, 5 hours, drinking sodas, eating sandwiches, having fun, and taking 100% of the credit for this great thing that happened in his community under his watch, right? And so, this is how you build that relationship with the local population so that they advocate for you. They don't just support you, they advocate, right? When somebody at the national level is holding up a permit, we can get on the phone to the mayor or the vice mayor or somebody in their office and say, hey, look, we're not able to get this project going. We're not able to hire people. We're not able to, pay more taxes because we've created more value, sold some properties. Now property taxes are up, right? We can't do any of this stuff until this logjam gets removed. Do you mind heading down to, the national office or wherever it is and seeing if you can just get it back on the top of the stack for us, right? And so they become advocates because they understand that they benefit at so many levels from us being there. And that's the kind of engagement that I think over 33 years has worked. The disadvantage, Eugene, is that it takes a long time that first time because they don't necessarily believe that you're going to do that, right? So you've got to kind of prove it out early, and then people know, well, yeah, this is a good relationship.
So how long is a long time?
Depends. Right now, a horror story. Right now, I'm dealing with a situation in Panama that's taken 4 years, But I mean, if you look at entitlement process in the U.S., I mean, I read horror stories in the U.S. Somebody buys a property in, California is probably the worst, right? Buy a property in California and try to get it entitled. And by the time you deal with the local and this and the neighbors and all this stuff, it could be years, right? Or even decades, right?
I've worked on a project for over 20 years and I ended up losing it. So well, there's that.
There you go, right? There you go. So sometimes at the beginning, it'll take, in Panama, we're in year 4. The good news is once it breaks free, which I think it will break free in Q1, it looks like it is breaking free. The process beyond that to get the rest of the entitlement is much faster than the U.S. I would say that we will have are entitled, or phase one, I mean, initial entitlements for the first rollout by the summer, right? We're talking, you know, 90, 120 days. Because, and again, a lot of places where we work, we are the only project. There might be a house here and a house there, maybe a barn going up or something, right? But we're out in the countryside. And so we are the big project. And so the entitlements tend to happen much quicker once they release. But that up and until they release, it can, you know, can take a while.
So for context, what size, what type of a project are we talking about?
The one in Panama, it's 110 acres. And we will roll out with a small phase one, somewhere around 12 to 15 acres. So about, you know, 15% of it. And we're actually kind of interested. We're going to partner up with a long-term continuing care provider in the U.S. who will build out sort of the anchor tenant, which is a long-term continuing care facility. We will then build, you know, homes and residential, not just homes, condos, whatever, apartments, residential product around it. It'll become the anchor to this 110-acre property. It's really cool because it's about halfway, quote unquote, up the hill. The town of David, the city of David, is the second biggest city in Panama. The town of Boquete is up in a valley, but cool, very cool. Springtime all the time, and our property is about halfway. David has a fantastic hospital, Costco, shopping centers, malls, groceries, banks, I mean, everything, right? And Boquete is a little town with about 5,000 or 6,000 Canadian expats, many who have been there for, you know, 15, 20 years, and they're aging, and they don't want to go back to the U.S. or Canada at this point. They want to stay local. And so, you know, we're going to put in this facility that would allow them to continue to have their friends. I mean, they're, you know, 45 minutes from their friends and activities, you know, as long as they can engage them, but they're going to be 35, 40 minutes from a major, awesome hospital, shopping. So kind of split the difference on that. But it's a neat rollout and it really fits a need in the marketplace, specifically for that. We also expect that many North Americans, because look, long-term continuing care in the States is, if you want private care, it's $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 a month, right? You want good care. That's kind of the number. And we can deliver the same kind of care with, you know, nursing care, doctor, PT, all of the various elements for about a third of that number, for about $2,500 to $3,000 a month, because so much of the care element is labor. Right. And so labor is so much less expensive. And also the regulatory burdens that cause a lot of the price lifts and things like that. Right. So without a lot of the regulatory burden and a lot of the cost of labor, we'll be able to provide what would cost $8,000 to $10,000 in the U.S. for between $2,500 and $3,000. So we think there's a domestic market for the product as well. But we're actually building it initially for the market that's already in Panama. So, yeah.
Got it. So if I understand correctly, this is primarily targeting expats or English-speaking community.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that your typical target market?
Our typical target market has been, we've been developing in the region for, you know, 30 years now, right? 30 years. And the typical market for the first 25 of those years wasn't a U.S. Canadian expat retiree. That was the bullseye. We had other people around the bullseye, but that was the bullseye. Post-COVID, the numbers are staggering. I just saw a Gallup poll from December of last year, just a month ago. This is incredible. 40% of women between the ages of 18 and 44 would leave the U.S. today if they had the opportunity. 40% of women 18 to 44, right? And I'll come back to that in a second. 34% of retirees would seriously consider a move overseas for health care, cost of living, quality of life. So a third of retirees are now considering, it used to be 10%. Pre-COVID, it was 10%. It was 11.6, but 1 in 10 pre-COVID. Now it's up to about a third of U.S. society, for whatever reason, is considering a property overseas. So that's a huge change. The thing that's changing in the marketplace is, you know, we're continuing to see this retiree segment, but we're gonna go niche. We're really gonna start to drill into this long-term continuing care with a community around it. So, you know, an active adult community, but it gives the people the transition ability because they're not going back, right? Once they leave their house and they move, like they don't want to go back. Most aren't. But the other element that's really exciting, and I think this is where the opportunity is for maybe some of your listeners, is the opportunity to serve a digital nomad, right? These women who are, you know, 18 to 44, call them 25 to 35, right? Like most of them do not have the money to buy a property, right? But they are going to move, and many of them are already coming. The digital nomad wave is happening. I mean, many of these countries have actually created what they call digital nomad visas, right? It's a visa literally called a digital nomad visa, right? They give them a 1 or 2 year visa, come down as long as they're working remotely. They're not taking a job in the country. They'll let them stay there for a year or two, but they're not buying property. They're renting property. And so the opportunity to serve this digital nomad who's going to rent for 3 months, 6 months, a year is exploding. And that is an area of expertise that we have capitalized on. And I personally am helping folks through my consulting business to identify that as well. And because I mean, the market's huge. And like the more people that do it and the more people that do it well, the more people who are going to come. I mean, we're talking about, you know, tens of millions of people, right? I am not like some people say, well, Mike, why would you help somebody else do this? Because I can't serve 10 million people. That's why. Let's help a lot of people do this. You know, and it's the idea of the miracle mile with the car dealerships, right? You put one car dealership way out of town, maybe some people come to it. You stick 15 car dealerships along a mile, everyone goes there, right? And so this idea of cluster, which Harvard, you know, Harvard talks a lot about this too, right? There's empirical data that supports it. The cluster element works. And so I want to do everything I can to help as many people get overseas and do this kind of development because it creates the market. It establishes the validity of this product.
Amazing. So help me understand the business model, your business model.
Yeah,
you
sure.
are developing these projects.
Right.
Is your model to build and sell, or do you hold on to them and rent them out?
Interesting. Up and until recently, it was always build and sell because the rental market wasn't, the retiree is going to sell a house in the U.S., generally move for, you know, 15, maybe 10, 15, 20 years, but 15 year in their mind. They're coming when they're whatever, 65, 70, they're going to, you know, whatever, stay through their 80s. The problem is and was that many, that, like there was no easy button, right? There was no easy button to say, well, when I'm 85, 88, and I start to, you know, need help, you can hire it. That's the beautiful thing. In Latin America, you can absolutely hire it very, very affordably. But if you're doing it yourself, there's no economy of scale. A full-time nurse, most people have maids, right? A maid and a gardener. So you have that kind of help, right? But most people don't need a nurse full-time. They'd like to have a nurse around, but if you could share that nurse with, you know, 10 other people, right? Now you have economy of scale and maybe the cook, right? And other types of things or the PT people or the PT facilities. Like you have a whole set of equipment, right? If you use it once a day for an hour, well, you know, I mean, like there's no economy of scale. So what we've figured out is how to build this long-term continuing care. So the people who, when they hit their 80s and they say, well, I don't want to go back to the States. Now they have the easy button. Well, let's just transition. We'll sell the house we bought 15 years ago. We'll buy something here. Maybe they'll rent and sell and rent. I don't know. I mean, there's lots of models. But to answer your question, we are now looking at and building into our development and financial models this own and rent mostly for digital nomads, but it could be also for the long-term continuing care folks as well. This is all brand new, and we're really just starting to model it out and see how we want to implement. Panama will be the first implementation, and I think we're going to do some of both. We're going to have ownership. We're going to have rental. By the way, that community is not for digital nomads. That one really is specifically for we have properties in Belize on Ambergris Key that are much more digital nomad properties. Nicaragua, same things. Locations matter to what clientele you want to serve as well.
I understand. And how do you finance them? What's your source of equity, if you don't mind me asking? And then what about debt financing? Is it U.S.-based lenders or local lenders? How do you get the deals financed?
It's all private equity. There really is no lending source. Reasonable. Let me say that. There's no reasonable lending source in Latin America, nor do any U.S. lenders really lend for projects overseas. So you're really talking about private equity, private lending, and the costs associated with that are higher. They are certainly higher than what you would normally see you know, in the U.S. for sure. One of the things that's really important is, you know, one of my very first business overseas, I helped start a mortgage company in Belize. 23 years ago, we turned it into a bank. So we're now a bank in Belize, but we're still largely a mortgage company. We don't finance developers or development, but we finance the buyer, right? So we've actually been able to, we were the first bank to do it. And we're still one of the very few banks in the region that will lend money to foreigners in a country to buy a product there. And so we've added a liquidity element to the marketplace that heretofore was not, you know, was not there. I think that's an important element because even though the developer has to come and either borrow the money or get private equity, equity's way better than borrowing money, by the way, because time stretch out, right? And if you're paying an interest payment, like that's a rough deal. So private equity, equity partners, things like that. But once the client purchases the property, then the bank can step in and cash out for the developer, right? So that element of liquidity is critically important in the marketplace. I would say it's growing slowly. It's not growing quickly. It's growing slowly, but it is becoming more and more available to the retail client. I don't see anyone loaning money to developers at a rate of interest that would make it viable.
And my understanding is that in many of those markets, you can't pre-sell a lot of the properties, right? Unlike yes. many states here restrict pre-sales or restrict the amount of money you could take. Over yeah. there, it's more pre-sales are a lot more common.
They are. And in fact, pre-sales, once you're building a home, work, right? The issue is how do you build out all the infrastructure ahead of time? That money has to come from somewhere, right? And sadly, a lot of projects fund their construction of everything on pre-sales, which is pretty dangerous because like, you know, if pre-sales stop for any reason, I mean, COVID, right? I mean, whatever, 2008, you know, stop, right? Lots of reasons things can stop. So like you do see a lot of half-built projects in the region because it was built on a pre-sale basis. You know, once you have the horizontal, let's just call it that. Once you have the horizontal in place and funded and paid for, then I am an advocate of pre-sales. So we're going to build a house for you. Great. You know, okay, no problem. You're going to put, you know, 50% down, 20-20-10 or whatever the stages are, you know, to get it done. And typically that's what you see. See about a 50%. Sometimes it's 10% down, you know, 30-20 real fast because a lot of stuff has to get ordered, right? And a lot of the builders don't have the money to do that. So the pre-sales work. My counsel, my concern to a consumer, anyone listening, is if you are going to enter into a pre-sale type of contract with a developer, make sure that the horizontal is done, right? That you're not funding that with your pre-sale. And then, I always counsel people never negotiate the price. Don't negotiate the price. If it's a reasonable price, take the price. Negotiate the terms, right? Less upfront, less on each progress payment, right? So that you spoon feed or eyedropper the developer just enough money to get your house built so that, you know, he's not all, he doesn't have 80% of your money, 90% of your money, and 50% of your house is done, right? So I'm a big advocate of if the price is okay, don't negotiate the price, negotiate the terms because that's what protects you, the consumer, in a buyer beware environment, which is what, you know, the developing world is. It's buyer beware. So,
right. Well, and we've all heard horror stories, even here onshore, with pre-sales going bust or private equity. I mean, syndications going upside down and people losing money. EB-5. There's been so many
yes.
issues with foreign investors pouring their funds in U.S. projects and then going upside down. How do you build that trust with people? I mean,
yeah.
It's hard enough here in the land of, you know, AI and internet and where you could find information about anybody, but you go to a small town or country, different languages, different transparency rules. What would be your advice and what's your experience?
Well, you know, it's hard. And look, at the beginning, it's super hard. The longer you're in business, the more times that you deliver what you say you're going to deliver on your commitments, the easier it is. And I think that's, you know, look, start small, right? Start small that you don't have to raise a lot of money. And that's actually a lesson we learned. We rolled out about, I don't know, I'll make up a number, 60, 70 acres. I'm close on that in our Grand Pacifica project in Nicaragua. And 2000, we started building the infrastructure in 2004. We had all of our roads, water, sewer, fiber, everything in the ground by end of six, you know, into early seven. And we're selling like crazy. I mean, the sky's the limit, baby, right? In 2007, right? And so we figured, yeah, 60 acres with about 300 home sites in there. And 2008, boom, it just, everything turned off, right? I mean, thank God we already put in all the infrastructure, right? And any of the pre-sales were on product homes. And I think by the time everything kind of collapsed in 2008, I don't know, we had, I'll make up a number, 20 homes, something like that. But 20 homes on 60 acres feels empty. I mean, like it just felt super empty. And so the lesson that I took from that as a developer is, you know, every time now we tackle something, even if we think things are going gangbusters, we're just going to bite off tiny little bites because then you can create real density, right? And density is what makes it feel like a neighborhood. I mean, in hindsight, I think, you know, we can see that at the time it looked like, you know, we were going to sell out and, you know, we're going to have 200 houses there pretty quick and right on through. But the other side of it is on the money side, Eugene, is that, you know, if let's say you take down, you buy a 100-acre parcel, you heard me say, we have 110 acres in Panama. We're going to chew off, you know, 10, 15, depends on what we need. But not all of it will be developed. I mean, we're building a lake, right? We have a beautiful stream that runs through the property. So part of this 15 acres is going to be a couple acre lake. And I mean, that's why I don't really know what the number is. But like, we're biting off this tiny little piece so that whatever we do there is going to feel very complete right away. Even if the market falls off and nothing else happens, well, you've got a nice little, you know, nice little community there, right? And but the money it takes to develop 10 acres is significantly less than to develop the other. So I think the smaller bite is probably the answer that you were looking for on the advice. What would you do? I would say take a very small bite and a bite that you can afford. I would not find debt. I would try to find, you know, equity partners that would step in for some piece of the project, maybe. Lots of ways to structure deals, of course, but I would find patient capital. There's really patient capital. And sorry, I chased some rabbits around the field there. I don't know where.
No, hey, that's perfect. That's great advice. Well, with that, to follow up with, you know, with private investors and private equity and partners, I can't help but think about your liability and responsibility, especially, I mean, all I know about the news that come from that region is crime, drug lords, you know, you cross the street in the wrong place and then all of a sudden there's a gang with machine guns. I can't even imagine taking $1 million from somebody and then them being upset with you.
Right.
How do you navigate that?
Yeah, a couple things. One, you know, crime is local, right? Crime is local. There, I mean, if you said, you know, Seattle, Washington's a dangerous city, like probably that's a true statement some places. If you said Seattle's a safe city, well, that's true some places too, right? So both statements are true, but they don't really capture any reality, right? And so crime is very local generally. The other thing about drug dealers and drug industry is that it's a business, right? And their business is to produce the drugs and transport the drugs and sell the drugs. And Central America is a transit zone for sure, right? I mean, drugs are going from South America to North America, right on up through Central America or in the water, whatever it is, right? Anytime anything happens to slow that down, it costs the drug dealers money, right? It costs them money. They don't want violence. They don't want hassle. They don't want friction. They want to make the most money they can possibly make. And the way that happens is they get their stuff from point A to point B, and nothing in the middle happens. And so we as a company, sometimes people say, Mike, you ever get, we have a huge piece of property. Our Grand Pacifica property is 3.5 miles of Pacific Ocean frontage and a mile deep, right? It's 2,500 acres. And I remember early on, when it finally dawned on us that we were building a small town, right? you know, we're building a small town, 3.5 miles by a mile. That's a small town, right? And so we hired an urban planner, Urban Design Associates out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You know, they know how to build towns, right? So we hired them to help us build a town. But people would sometimes ask me, Mike, why don't you put an airstrip in there? I'm like, because there are people who want to land an airplane at 2 a.m. that you don't want to say no to. We will never, as long as I'm CEO, and we will never have an airstrip on any of our properties ever. Like, just don't make the problem, right? If you don't have an airstrip, you don't have to say no, right? So like the whole issue of drugs and drug dealers and violence is really one that's way overblown from a media standpoint. And if you do business the correct way, you don't pay bribes, you don't put yourself in any kind of, you know, way of inhibiting or adding friction to anybody's business, like, they're going to leave you alone. Then you look at the governments, right? And you'd say to yourself, well, how about the governments? Aren't they going to take your property? No, because the first time a government takes your property, like, believe me, if any of the governments in Central America took our property, I'd be at the embassy. I would be in every newspaper. And the amount of direct foreign investment to that country would dry up. I mean, who's going to go put money in a country where they just took an American's property, right? No, these folks, they all get it. The governments get it. Like, we don't ask for favors, by the way. We never ask for favors, ever. I don't want any favors. I just want to be able to do my business. And that's the relationship we have with the government. We don't pay bribes, but we also don't ever ask for any favors. And so I think that some of these things that we've done have definitely ensured the success of our business. And I use the word thus far. I mean, you know, right? I mean, you know, 33 years. I mean, but you know, I think, you know, you can't predict the future, but I think they're great business principles, and we apply them, and they mitigate a lot of the risk. They don't eliminate risk, but they mitigate a great deal of the risk.
So I have to ask, was there a story how you found out about the airstrip and that somebody might want to use it?
No. Just people would ask me. No, I just in my head, I just kind of intuitively knew. I'm just like, no way. Like, if you build an airstrip, like, somebody's going to want to land their plane at 2 a.m. and it's not the person you would ever want to say no to, right? I'm just like, nope.
That makes sense.
Nah.
That makes sense. What about the language? Do you speak Spanish?
No, not really.
Okay.
I lived in Nicaragua for 14 years, Eugene, and I really never learned the language very well. I got a bunch of funny stories about it, but anyway.
Okay, so you really can get by with what you carry an interpreter around?
Well, we hired an entirely bilingual staff, because when we started working in Belize back in 94, right? And Belize is English, so I didn't need to learn a new language, right? And so we started to build our human resource infrastructure in Belize, accounting, marketing, you know, engineering, some stuff like that. And then when we bought the property in Nicaragua in 2000, now we're in a Spanish-speaking country, right? And so immediately we hired and I spoke no Spanish, none. I spoke no Spanish. I moved there in 2002 and lived there for 14 years. And the day I moved there, I spoke literally no Spanish. And so I had to hire a bilingual staff, which we did. And that's been, you know, it's been wonderful, because I'm a big fan of people, by the way. I look, it's a company is people. Yeah, it's assets. And don't get me wrong, it's all important stuff. But at the end of the day, if you want the assets to be productive in any way, it's always about people. Your people are your most valuable asset. And so by hiring bilingual staff in Nicaragua, we really got to jump on some things that we wouldn't have had I spoken great Spanish. So I actually believe, I wish I would have spent more time learning Spanish. I do. I regret. It's actually a regret. I have very few regrets in life, but that actually is one of them, that I didn't learn Spanish very well when I lived there. But from a business standpoint, I think our business benefited greatly because I didn't speak Spanish. We had to hire fully bilingual people, and it allowed a very fluid communication between our Belize team, our U.S. team, our Nicaraguan team, because there was never a language barrier inside the company, because English became the official language of our company, which let it work. So anyway.
But then help me understand. So when you first come into a country, and, you know, if any of the listeners want to try doing business in any of the Spanish-speaking countries, you need to hire, you know, you start by hiring a couple of people that would help you out, your support staff. Then you go to meet. Well, two questions there. One is, how do you vet them? First time you meet with them, how do you know that they're not going to screw you? And then also, I'm sure that has happened.
Has. I was going to say, you don't, right? You don't. But you don't in the U.S. either, right? I mean, you know, right? Look, I believe, I've always believed that you hire character. Like, if you need an accountant, you need to interview 10 accountants or 20 accountants. But at the end of the day, you hire the accountant who has the best character, or the character that resonates with you. You know, and I'm certainly not done a perfect job of hiring. And you know, I would say I've done a good job of hiring, maybe not even a great job, right? Because we've had people we've hired who've stolen from us and taken kickbacks, and it's cost the company a lot of money. I mean, we had one of our inspectors, I assume he was taking kickbacks because he wasn't inspecting what he was supposed to be inspecting, and what they put in the ground wasn't right, right? And it's cost us a lot of money over the years, you know? So I'm not sure, you know, I think I've done a good job, but one of the things that I drill hard when I'm hiring is character. I ask a lot of character issues. I take people out of the environment. Like, you interview a bunch of people quick. I mean, it's 30 minutes, whatever, sort it from, you know, 10 to 3. But those last three, I tend to do something with them. Take them to dinner. Take them out to Grand Pacific. There was nothing out there, right? Let's take a walk. Let's look at what's here. I look for traits and characteristics that say this is a good person. I'll tell you a story how we hired our farm manager. I mean, first he was a farm manager, then he became property manager. We interviewed a bunch of people out at Grand Pacifica. It was a dirt road back then, now it's paved. I mean, anyway, and we're driving out after the interviews, the day is over, and there's this guy with this stick, and the stick must have been 15 feet long, and he's got it up in the tree, banging a tree along the side of the road. And I asked Marvin, who was my very first hire, by the way, Marvin. He had gotten the Sam Walton Scholarship. He was a Nicaraguan, went to Arkansas with the Sam Walton Scholarship, spoke perfect English, did a second fellowship in Japan, spoke Japanese. I mean, you can find these kinds of people, right? Anyway, great guy. Anyway, so I asked Marvin, I was like, Marvin, isn't that Domingo? We just talked to him. He goes, yeah. So we stopped the car, put the window down, and Marvin's, Domingo only spoke Spanish. It was a farm manager. We didn't need the English. And whatever, so I hear the conversation. He goes, Mr. Cobb, this is a very rare, almost extinct tree. And Domingo's knocking some of the seeds out of it. He hasn't seen one in a while because, you know, we're not near his house. And he says, he's going to take the seeds back and plant them to grow some baby, nearly extinct tree. And I'm like, I said, that's great. Good. As soon as the window was up, we're hiring him. You know, we're hiring him, right? I mean, it was just one of those character issues of like, wow. And so, you know, I don't have great answers, Eugene. I just think that we have to hire really high quality people that have the character that fits with our character. And we do the best job possible to not hire people who are going to take advantage of us. Anyway.
But if you don't mind me pressing down a little bit on kickbacks. So, I mean, my understanding is in that part of the world, kickbacks are commonplace, and especially in construction, where, you know, your example was inspections, but in construction, I mean, you've got five different subs or five different contractors, and then you've got your project manager who needs to make a decision or recommendation to you who to pick. And chances are that whether they're taking them or not, they are definitely being offered the kickbacks.
Absolutely.
So, what's your attitude towards that? Do you just let it be, or do you try to fight it? Do you try to incentivize it? And what would your recommendation be for?
Yeah, look, that's again, depending on what we're hiring for, we would, you know, interview differently, question differently, right? But at the end of the day, we're trying to find people who have what I would call true cash register honesty, right? I mean, if that cash register has to, you know, down to the penny every day. And if there's a penny missing, they're going to get on their hands and knees and look around on the floor to find the penny that fell out, right? I mean, and by the way, there are great testing tools in Spanish as well, right? I mean, there are great testing tools that allow you to do this evaluation. We do that mostly in our finance people. We have not done it on our project manager, which is kind of interesting. And I've made a note that maybe we do want to do it over there too. But we've had pretty good, I say luck, we've had success. I mean, some of it's luck, but I think we've gotten a lot better at identifying the project managers or the foreman who won't take a bribe, right? And But to answer your question, no, it's absolutely not tolerated at all. When it's spotted, the contractor's gone. And a lot of our clauses have, it's all in Spanish, it's all civil law, and you have to be really careful about how you do it. But our lawyers understand that if a contractor's paying kickbacks and we can validate it, that we can terminate their contract cause, right? And anybody who works for us, who's on our payroll, they just know, like, if that happens, like, they're out, you know, and it takes a little while, but word gets around. And I think we've done a pretty good job of saying, like, we're just not going to tolerate it. We're not going to tolerate it. And recently that's not been an issue. It was early on. Somebody put, gray water pipes in the ground instead of the pressure rated PVC. That was the big one for us. And we've just had water break after water break after water break for 15 years, because of the wrong pipe in the ground. Right. So anyway, I mean, just one of those, just like, but it is what it is. Yeah.
Right. Makes sense. Wow. This is amazing. This is amazing. Mike, this has been very unusual conversations for me. I mean, I've been to Belize once years ago. We were on a cruise, so we were only there for a day, but interesting country. I've been to Mexico plenty of times, and so many times we rented a house and stayed there for a couple of weeks, and I enjoyed the service, and there's usually a staff and cleaning and gardeners, and it's all cool. And we walk around and we see a spot, and I'm like, I wonder if we could just buy this land and build it. But then I start thinking through the process. I'm like, no, I don't want to deal with it. It just sounds like a nightmare.
Well, you know, it can be, but by the way, we are acquiring right now, we're in the final stages of the powers of attorney, and maybe next week it'll be done, in Belize, 1600 acres of property in Belize, that we will be inviting development partners. It'll be the first time we've really opened up. We've done everything ourselves, but this project, because it's 1600 acres and we want to look at some acceleration of development, we are going to be out looking for development partners. And Belize is common law. And the other reason is that Belize is the easy button in Central America. English is the official language. Common law, which is what we understand. Civil law is so different, radically different, right? It's easy to get to. It's popular. So, this may be an opportunity that you and I could talk about at some point, or one of your listeners, if they're looking to do sort of their first toe in the water of development overseas, this property may be a place that they would want to take a look at. I mean, just, it's a phone call or it's an email, it's a trip, it's an airplane ticket, come to Belize, look at it. And if there's something that would be a good fit for that property, it really will be the easy button for somebody looking to develop in Central America or the Caribbean. So
sounds good. You're welcome to share a little bit more information, how much you're raising, what your projections are, if you want.
We're actually not raising. We're going to go in, we're going to put in the horizontal on the first phase. First phase is about 1,000 acres, and we're going to bite off about 20. Again, small piece, right? We're going to put in the horizontal on 20. But we're going to run some focus groups in Q1, later in Q1 into Q2, to really get a sense of what our customer base. I mean, we have a database of about 400,000 folks, not all interested in Belize, but have expressed an interest in owning a property overseas in the last 30 years. It's an active database. We market to it. We have newsletters and stuff like that, right? So we're going to run some focus groups on our Belize specific elements of that list. Say, what are you looking for? What would be attractive? Are you looking for multifamily, single family, condo, price points, and then we even get to the point of talking about things like, how restrictive do you want? And the beautiful thing about 1600 acres is we can have four or five different neighborhoods. We could have a very unrestricted neighborhood where somebody could put a yurt or, a Mennonite home or whatever. And then we're going to have some very restricted neighborhoods with higher HOA fees, underground utilities, where you're going to have certain square footages and home styles. So, but we get into that in our focus groups, because what we really want to do is make sure that we're building a product that somebody wants to own. See, I don't ever want to be in the business of selling a product, right? I want to be in the business of serving a consumer. And the way you do that is to really understand what it is somebody wants to own. And then within reason, build that for them. And so, as we get into it, Eugene, I'll be happy to share more information with you as we get further down the road. But what we really are looking for is someone to come along and say, I'll take 5 acres of that, and I'll put in, you know, 10 homes on 5 acres or a small, you know, apartment or condo building or whatever. You know, and that's the kind of partnership that we would look at, but there's not any kind of specificity at this point that we could talk about. But by summer there will be. By summer there will be.
Got it. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
Hey, but I do have one plug. I'd love to plug my book. May I plug
please
my
do.
Book? Thank you. Look, this book is a labor of love. It's my professional service. I sell it on Amazon, but for anybody listening today, if you just simply send me an email, podcast@ecidevelopment.com, I'll send you a coupon from Amazon. You can download the book for free. If you have ever thought about going overseas, moving overseas, living overseas, investing overseas, this book is chock full of all the kinds of due diligence resources and thought-provoking ideas and concepts to help you get it right the first time. Send an email, just the subject line, just say something like Mike's book or whatever, and we'll get you the coupon from Amazon. My gift to you. I'm a big fan of people, you know, in taking that spirit of adventure that's inside them and engaging it and engaging it well, right? Engaging it in a way that lets it happen successfully. And the book, my book, How to Buy Your Home Overseas, really helps people do that. So thank you, Eugene. I appreciate the opportunity to share that.
Excellent. Thank you, Mikey. And we'll put the email address in the show notes. Is there a website or anything else or social media you would like to include in the show notes?
No. I mean, if somebody hits us there, I mean, they can find ecidevelopment.com, our website as well. But we'd love to hear from folks and, you know, have a great conversation if there's something to talk about.
Excellent. Thanks again, Mike.
Thanks, Eugene.